time for Rockin' the Boat. My name is the V-Man. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org.
Well, the amount of money, the average cost of a wedding now is $20,000. Now, that couldn't buy you a house most places, maybe in North Dakota, but it could put a down payment on a house or other real estate, or you could take a trip around the world and get some culture. You could further your education. I can't imagine how it got like this, how it got so complicated and expensive and ostentatious, I think is the word.
That's Adrienne Rain Burke. She's my guest today as we discuss The Anarchist's Wedding Guide, 11 Reasons Not to Go Through With It, lighter fare for this summertime, the time of wedding bells. Stay tuned for Rockin' the Boat, coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Today on Rockin' the Boat, an interview with Adrienne Rain Burke, author of The Anarchist's Wedding Guide, 11 Reasons Not to Go Through With It, which was featured on the Counterpunch website in late June. We'll talk about love and life, art and poetry, war and peace. Every summer, a familiar ritual is repeated again and again as thousands of couples tie the knot. My guest today, Adrienne Rain Burke, questions the practices of traditional weddings and argues against getting married in her essay, The Anarchist's Wedding Guide, 11 Reasons Not to Go Through With It. Adrienne Rain Burke describes herself as a freelance journalist, poet, and artist on a relentless but largely unsuccessful job search. She holds no degrees or credentials of any kind, which might have something to do with her current job status. Adrienne Rain Burke maintains two websites where you can read her works. They are The War on Art and The Postmodern Blues, which are hosted on geocities.com and angelfire.com, respectively. She is a native of Los Angeles, California, where she resides in what she describes an illicit love nest with her lover of 28 years, six cats, and a Siamese fighting fish. Adrienne Rain Burke is also the mother of two middle-aged children and was once married to their father. Adrienne, I want to welcome you to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Your article is a very interesting piece, and it brought up some thoughts for me personally. Tell me first the title. Are you an anarchist?
Well, yes, I am. I'm a moderate anarchist. You know, there are leftist socialist anarchists, and there are right-wing anarchists. Well, I'm sort of a middle-of-the-road anarchist. It's unusual, but it could happen. It happened this time.
Go a little further with that description. What do you mean by middle-of-the-road anarchist?
Well, I don't think we need to abolish all capitalism, and I don't think we need to forbid all socialist structures. I think the primary purpose of being an anarchist is to create a non-coercive, non-authoritarian state, and I think there's room for different kinds of cultures and societies within that framework.
What elements of capitalism in your ideal world would we hold on to?
Street vending, mainly. I don't care much for corporations. In fact, I think they should be abolished altogether. But I think people should be able to things and sell them if they wish to. Or grow them and sell them. Or trade them, barter, you know.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about marriage. It is summertime, and as I mentioned, June is also sort of traditionally referred to as the time to get married. We're now into July, but summertime is still traditionally when the wedding bells are ringing, etc., and people are kind of going through this ritual, ceremonial kind of thing where it's sort of hedonistic celebrating and the like. But in this society, I mean, the institution of marriage, it's almost a joke, really, because largely people end up in divorced or like marriages end up in, like, you know, people cheating on each other or abuse happening or those kinds of things. Tell me why you are opposed to marriage and some of the points you raise in your article.
Well, first of all, I want to mention that I don't really want to abolish marriage, and I don't want to reform it. I don't believe it can be reformed. I just propose abandoning it. There are other arrangements you can make with your life, and you don't have to tell anyone. The state has no business in all of this. And in my opinion, the church doesn't either, but that's also a personal matter. Once the state steps in with a pre-made contract that you never read before you sign, and they can change it at any moment. It's subject to change without notice and without your permission. So it seems very silly. Under no other circumstances would you sign a contract like that. And I don't see any reason why you should sign one just because you're in love or drunk or in some other weakened condition, mental condition. So that's the first thing is the fact that the legal angle of this contract is pretty much unknown to everyone, and it's unknowable since it can change any time. Well, if we had a Bush in every state house, you know, a nice fundamentalist right-wing person, the laws of surrounding marriage could change very drastically and very suddenly so that women would be once again enjoined to obey their husbands as they were once.
Your piece, The Anarchist's Wedding Guide, 11 Reasons Not to Go Through It, begins, quote, "Besides costing enough to feed a village in Madagascar, the traditional wedding ceremony is a conglomeration of ancient leftovers from every culture we've destroyed, absorbed, aped, or inherited on the way to our present pinnacle of enlightenment. The wedding party, the ring, little things like the placement of large numbers of ceremonial people around the altar where the joinery is executed, all symbols, remnants of forgotten cultural baggage, much of it quite unpleasant." And you go on to talk about some of these in detail. Maybe you can give our listeners sort of a history of the traditional marriage practices that we witness in modern times and where a lot of these symbols, as you refer to, came from.
Well, first of all, in most modern weddings, one of the things that you will see a lot of is that the bride is given away by her father. Now, a lot of times these days she's just walked down the aisle and sort of handed over. But in some ceremonies, they still ask, who gives this woman in marriage? And the father says, I do. Now, that comes from a time when women were given in marriage by their families, and they didn't have anything to say about it. And that's one example of a kind of a demeaning attitude towards women. Then there's she's wearing a veil over her face. And in law, in Blackstone's law in the old days, the veiled woman had a specific legal meaning. It meant a woman who did not act for herself. She was represented by her husband or her father or her son or the nearest male relative, or they could just appoint a male to represent her interests. And it was a source of great evil if she had any means or anything that anyone would want, because not everyone who represents you is necessarily going to be on your side. So it would be nice to acknowledge the root of some of these things and take a look at them and see, is this the kind of symbolism we want to keep? Why is the declaration made, I declare you man and wife? You know, he retains some status here, and she becomes a subordinate. Her name changes, and not only does it change, actually, in etiquette to, say, Mrs. Mary Jones from Mrs. Mary Smith, but it becomes Mrs. John Jones. And that makes it very hard to find women. If you want to look up your old classmates, you're going to have to look for, Mrs. Harold somebody. So that's another problem, is that the entire structure in some ways represents the handover from the patriarch to the husband or to a new patriarch. And I think that the ceremony itself is not only demeaning, but it's also ridiculously expensive. I mean, if people want to get together and have a party, I am all for it. I love nothing better than a good party. even if what it's celebrating is a contract that I don't particularly care for, but the cost of it is obscene in a world where not only where other people are going hungry, but where the young couple could possibly buy a house with this with the amount of money. The average cost of a wedding now is $20,000. Now that couldn't buy you a house most places, maybe in North Dakota, but it could put a down payment on a house or other real estate, or you could take a trip around the world and get some culture. You could further your education. I can't imagine how it got like this, how it got so complicated and expensive and ostentatious, I think is the word I'm looking for here.
You're tuned to Rockin' the Boat on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name's the V-Man. I'm joined by Adrian Rainberg, author of The Anarchist's Wedding Guide, 11 Reasons Not to Go Through with It. And today we're talking about the institution of marriage and the subjugation of women. I wanted to talk more about this idea of property. And you write in the article, in number six, the reason that you give is titled The Husband. And you write that, just one line, a husband is the keeper of livestock, and I don't have any. Because that's your answer as the reason not to go through with it. But maybe you can talk more about this term, husband, and I've never heard that husband is a keeper of livestock, and I find that very interesting in terms of what you brought up, women being propertied and such.
Well, the word spouse means a married person, but the origins of the word husband were kind of a householder, a person who of substance in the community, who kept livestock and a farm, and also that husbanding. There's a verb, husbanding, meaning to care for grain or to farm, to take care of livestock. So, yeah, that's the origin of the word, and it seems to be that the woman was one of the many things that he was caring for or managing. I mean, certainly livestock don't have many rights under law. But women really were chattel until fairly recently in English common law, which most America has been under. Actually, in California, there's a little element of Spanish common law, which oddly enough is somewhat fairer to women. But in any case, the husband as the boss, the keeper, the controller, that's was true up until the 70s. If you want me to go into the laws, I can a little bit. I'm familiar with it because I was in the feminist movement of the 70s, and I also saw my mother and other women of the previous generation go through the situation where, of course, in California, which was always, as I said, somewhat fairer to women, the woman was entitled to community property, which is half of the assets that were acquired during the marriage, not before the marriage. And so she was entitled to that, but the only way she could ever collect on it, if her husband decided to withhold it, was to get a divorce. So she wasn't entitled to the use of it while she was married. Essentially, he had complete control over the assets, and that included money that she earned. If it got into a bank account or anything, or he got his hands on it, he had no legal obligation to give it to her. So the law made him the controller of the assets of the family. If he abandoned her, he was guilty of desertion. But if he said, come on, we're moving to Saudi Arabia, France, Italy, England, North Dakota.
Wherever.
Yes.
Any town.
And she said, I don't want to go. She was guilty of desertion, and that didn't work the other way. Mm-hmm. They had decided that the husband and wife were one person, but that he was the one who made all the decisions. He was the brain of the operation, so to speak. So it wasn't an egalitarian arrangement, although it was, as I said, somewhat fairer than English common law, in which case the woman was completely chattel and had no no right to anything if they separated at one time, even if it was her money to begin with. So that was why I suppose the great English fear of fortune hunters and so on, because a man could marry a woman and put her out on the street and have complete control over her assets.
What changed in the 1970s? What was it in that era when women started to kind of sort of search for their rights and sort of assert themselves in law? What happened?
Well, you know, I'm not entirely sure. I think a lot of things were coming to the fore. I remember that I saw that my mother, when she got a divorce, kind of assumed the status of a child in law. Her signature wasn't good for a loan, even though she was a property owner. She had to have a male co-signer and so on. But I don't think I put it all together. It was a very, you know, the 60s were a very domesticated age still in the early eras. You know, Jacqueline Kennedy was our model, not the suffragists of the earlier time. But at some point, possibly because of all the other civil rights movements that were going on and that were making people aware of how law and custom affected, you know, their freedoms and lives, women started looking at their lives a little more critically. I remember one of the things that was constantly being brought up is you don't want to live like your mother. You don't want to live your mother's life. And that may have something to do with the fact that my generation's mothers were they were expected to be submissive. I don't know that all of them were, but I know that my mother not only vowed to obey her husband, she did it. And that is something, of course, that, as I said, I couldn't speak for everyone. I'm sure that individual women have always made their own contracts in their own way. But I think the very fact that one was expected to began to look very odd. You know, we were becoming educated women, and we were aware of the world around us. We weren't strictly housewives anymore. And why should we be told to obey anyone? However, I don't want to just emphasize only the woman's angle for this, because I don't think that marriage is fair to either party.
How is it unfair to men?
What?
How do you view it as unfair towards men?
The
role of sort of the breadwinner, the man has to sort of be this, you know, strong, dependable sort of figure who's sort of emotionless.
Well, that of course is, I think, the common, you know, inheritance of American men. But in marriage, you also have some very strange laws about divorce and child custody, which really discriminate against men very, very much. And I've seen this again and again, where a couple will separate and the man is legally enjoined and forced to pay child support, which I have, you know, he should, to the best of his, I mean, to the best of his ability and with his, in his capabilities. But his wife, the mother of his child, has a legal right, the right to the support of the child. And she can get the law to enforce it. But if she decides to never permit visitation to a perfectly decent father and husband, well, she's wrong, and she's legally wrong, but he has no right that the law will enforce. The police will not go out there and say, you've got to let him see his kid. It just won't happen.
What would happen if he showed up and demanded that?
She can say no. She can say, you can't come into my house. It would be very difficult. I've never heard of anyone, actually. I suppose if the man had a lot of money, you know, and a great legal team here, he could enforce that.
What do you believe is the overall net effect of this phenomenon you're describing?
Well, you know, as for men, Well, I think men have become rather bitter and angry about the whole situation often, especially if they've been married.
Does this lead to further problems, I guess, is where I'm going, maybe towards more, maybe might lead to a kidnapping, or it might lead to a stalking or a murder?
Oh, I'm very sure it does. Yeah. I'm very sure it does, because, the love of a person for their child, and this has, less to do with gender than it's, is one of the great moving things, and even in the animal kingdom. So yeah, people do step over the bounds sometimes, and I couldn't possibly say that's good. But I mean, the fact is that the laws aren't necessarily fair to men. The problem is that I suppose that they're laws. They aren't things that the people get together and agree on. They're imposed by some state force, and everything in our lives, when you come to some crisis in a marriage, becomes a matter of looking in books and finding out what someone said, and 50 years ago, and all the precedents and all of that, and spending a lot of money on lawyers. You can still lose after all of that. You can lose simply because the person disappears with your child, whether it's the mother or the father, and that happens too. So I've seen so many real injustices in this matter that I can't say that that all marriage laws favor men. It just isn't true. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that's why I say just abandon it. It can't be reformed. It isn't something that most of us can even influence. A huge movement like the women's movement did manage to change a few little things, like some of the credit laws. Now the man and woman are equally responsible to the other partner's creditors. But that's great for the creditors, but it doesn't really have a lot to do with their own rights and privileges. And maybe we would do better to make our own contracts or to leave it alone. I mean, maybe we don't need contracts. About the time you get out the start writing up the fine print, maybe the relationship is already on a very bad track.
If you're just joining us, you're tuned to Free Radio 96.3 on your FM dial, www.freakradio.org on your computer. My name's the V-Man. This is Rockin' the Boat, and I'm joined today in an interview with Adrienne Rayne Burke. She's the author of The Anarchist's Wedding Guide, 11 Reasons Not to Go Through with It. You can check that out at counterpunch.org. It's there in the June archives on Counterpunch website. And we're talking about weddings and life and love. I mentioned in the opening that you're the maintainer of two websites, The War on Art and The Postmodern Blues, which feature some of your writings. We have a few moments left, so maybe you could talk a little bit about what readers there will find on your websites. And maybe you could read one or two of your poems. You have a lot of political writings and stuff, and I found some of your poetry kind of interesting.
Sure. Well, The War on Art is a plea. so many people I grew up with became artists, and it's a pretty hopeless proposition for 99% of them. But one time, a few of us were talking about the then current war on drugs, in which case they were breaking an egg in a skillet and saying, "This is your brain on drugs." Completely irrational thing. I suppose it might impress somebody who couldn't, use logic. But we started thinking how this same argument could be used for anything, and we started playing around with the idea of actually, at the time, having an art show built around the idea of the war on art. This is your brain on art. And anyway, the rest fell away from it all, and some years later, I was going to do my own website, and I decided to do it on this particular subject. So this was my first website. It was The War on Art. And oddly enough, I get a lot of letters from people who wonder why I hate artists so much. But actually, I suppose what I was trying to do was dare to criticize the government's war on drugs. And also, I did want to expose some of the very hypocritical attitudes that people have towards art. Art is really revered in our society, and artists are considered entirely useless, routinely underpaid, and completely abused. So that is that one. And the other one is the postmodern blues. I used to write a political column, and I kind of missed it. So what I have there is some columns that I've written and some poetry.
There really is a war on art, though. I mean, thinking about some of the budget slashings that take place, usually the National Endowment for the Arts and various public TV and radio fundings are cut. And also thinking about just this current war in Iraq and the way that this cynical government invaded this country and just had no exit plan, no exit strategy. And once the so-called evil dictator was ousted from power, they allowed for the looting of the museums and the treasures that are not just Iraq treasures, but the world's treasures. I mean, these are ancient items that are cultural heritage of humanity. And it just kind of hearkened me to think of that when I read the title there. Maybe you can end with a reading a poem or two for us, Adrienne Rain Burke.
Sure, I will. I would like to say that now when you read the history books and you come into the words like vandal and barbarians, you can get a picture in your mind, and it'll be a picture of Donald Rumsfeld excusing or condoning the looting of the Baghdad Museum. Okay, collateral damage. They're only collateral damage, the ones we kill and maim and bomb to punish the unspeakably evil Saddam. We only bomb buildings, we said. Our bombs are smart and discreetly select targets indubitably dead. Bricks and mortar, steel and wood, empty cities and a lifeless waste. Warfare in the best of taste, because we are good. But if regrettably people should be in a house or a shelter or factory on which we intellectually drop a fiery notion or ballistic thought, it's quite accidental. Heaven knows that they were caught. The beast Saddam may have put them there as a decoy or a devilish snare. And it's a pity and a shame that they all went up in flame. Oh, it's a bitch, collateral damage, a bankrupt, sorry debt, uncollectible. And yet we do heartily regret that those charred and formless hunks of human meat and bone that once were children, moms, and dads, with family values not so different from our own, and jobs and bank accounts and credit cards, real estate and a cellular phone, will find it so damn difficult now to get a loan.
Collateral Damage, a poem by Adrienne Rain Burke. We're just about out of time, Adrienne, so maybe if you want to give us some final thoughts and maybe where people can read future articles.
I do occasionally put articles on my own website, which are The War on Art and Postmodern Blues, but I'm actually looking for a publisher now for The Anarchist's Wedding Guide, something a little larger than the thing I've written, simply because someone wrote me and gave me a very nice review and said that I really should consider making this into a book. Now, if that person had only been a publisher, I would be much more justified in expanding it into a book, but, you know, hope springs eternal, and I set out some long years ago with the idea that I was going to make my living from art, and I'm just too stupid to stop, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, it's been lovely being on your show, Vinny, and thank you very much.
And that is going to wrap it up for us tonight on Rockin' the Boat. Join me again Monday from 5:30 to 6 o'clock for another edition of Rockin' the Boat on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. 91.3 FM in Olympia, Washington, www.freakradio.org. Thanks for listening.